feet tall, transmitting quotes in Basque, Spanish, and English, all relating to the horrors of AIDS and the pain endured by those left behind. Langdon had to admit, the effect was mesmerizing and somehow heartbreaking. Perhaps you've seen Jenny Holzer's work before? Langdon felt hypnotized by the text coursing skyward. I bury my head. I bury your head. I bury you. Mr. Langdon, the voice in his head chimed, can you hear me? Is your headset working? Langdon was jolted from his thoughts. I'm sorry, what? Hello? Yes, hello, the voice replied. I believe we've already said our greetings. I'm just checking to see if you can hear me. I'm sorry, Langdon stammered, spinning away from the exhibit and looking out across the atrium. I thought you were a recording. I didn't realize I had a real person on the line. Langdon pictured a cubicle farm, manned by an army of curators armed with headsets and museum catalogs. No problem, sir. I'll be your personal guide for the evening. Your headset has a microphone in it as well. This program is intended as an interactive experience in which you and I can have a dialogue about art. Langdon could now see that other guests were also speaking into their headsets. Even those who had come as couples appeared to have separated a bit, exchanging bemused looks as they carried on private conversations with their personal docents. Every guest here has a private guide? Yes, sir. Tonight we are individually touring 318 guests. That's incredible. Well, as you know, Edmund Kirsch is an avid fan of art and technology. He designed this system specifically for museums in hopes of replacing group tours, which he despises. This way, every visitor can enjoy a private tour, move at his own pace, ask the question he might be embarrassed to ask in a group situation. It is really much more intimate and immersive. Not to sound old-fashioned, but why not just walk each of us around in person? Logistics, the man replied. Adding personal docents to a museum event would literally double the number of people on the floor and necessarily cut in half the number of possible visitors. Moreover, the cacophony of all the docents lecturing simultaneously would be distracting. The idea here is to make discussion a seamless experience. One of the objectives of art, Mr. Kirsch always says, is to promote dialogue. I entirely agree, Langdon replied, and that's why people often visit museums with a date or a friend. These headsets might be considered a bit antisocial. Well, the Brit replied, if you come with a date or friends, you can assign all the headsets to a single docent and enjoy a group discussion. The software is really quite advanced. You seem to have an answer for everything. That is, in fact, my job. The guide gave an embarrassed laugh and abruptly shifted gears. Now, Professor, if you move across the atrium toward the windows, you'll see the museum's largest painting. As Langdon began walking across the atrium, he passed an attractive 30-something couple wearing matching white baseball caps. Emblazoned on the front of both caps, rather than a corporate logo, was a surprising symbol. A tall, graceful capital letter A, whose left arm swept into a circle that wrapped around the letter. It was an icon Langdon knew well, and yet he had never seen it on a cap. In recent years, this highly stylized letter A had become the universal symbol for one of the planet's fastest-growing and increasingly vocal demographics, atheists, who had begun speaking out more forcefully every day against what they considered the dangers of religious belief. Atheists now have their own baseball caps? As he surveyed the congregation of tech-savvy geniuses mingling around him, Langdon reminded himself that many of these young analytical minds were probably very anti-religious, just like Edmund. Tonight's audience was not exactly the home crowd for a professor of religious symbology. Chapter 4 ConspiracyNet.com Breaking News Update Conspiracy Net's top 10 media stories of the day can be viewed by clicking here. Also, we have a brand new story just now breaking. Edmund Kearse surprise announcement? Tech titans have flooded Bilbao, Spain this evening to attend a VIP event hosted by futurist Edmund Kearse at the Guggenheim Museum. Security is extremely tight, and guests have not been told the purpose of the event. But ConspiracyNet has received a tip from an inside source suggesting that Edmund Kearse will be speaking shortly and is planning to surprise his guests with a major scientific announcement. ConspiracyNet will continue to monitor this story and deliver news as we receive it. Chapter 5 The largest synagogue in Europe is located in Budapest on Dohany Street. Built in the Moorish style with massive twin spires, the shrine has seats for more than 3,000 worshippers, with downstairs pews for the men and balcony benches for the women. Outside in the garden, in a mass burial pit, are interred the bodies of hundreds of Hungarian Jews who died during the horrors of the Nazi occupation. The site is marked by a tree of life, a metal sculpture depicting a weeping willow whose leaves are each inscribed with the name of a victim. When a breeze blows, the metal leaves rattle against one another, clattering with an eerie echo above the hallowed ground. For more than three decades, the spiritual leader of the great synagogue had been the eminent Talmudic scholar and Kabbalist, Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish, who, despite his advancing years and poor health, remained an active member of the Jewish community both in Hungary and around the world. As the sun set across the Danube, Rabbi Kirvish exited the synagogue. He made his way past the boutiques and mysterious ruin bars of Dohany Street, en route to his home on Marciusz 15 Square, a stone's throw from Elizabeth Bridge, which linked the ancient cities of Buda and Pest, which were formally united in 1873. The Passover holidays were fast approaching, normally one of Kirvish's most joyous times of the year, and yet, ever since his return last week from the Parliament of the World's Religions, he had been feeling only a bottomless disquiet. I wish I had never attended. The extraordinary meeting with Bishop Valdespino, Alama Sayed Al-Fadl, and futurist Edmund Kearse had plagued Kirvish's thoughts for three full days. Now, as Kirvish arrived home, he strode directly to his courtyard garden and unlocked his haziko, the small cottage that served as his private sanctuary and study. The cottage was a single room with high bookshelves that sagged under the weight of religious tomes. Kirvish strode to his desk and sat down, frowning at the mess before him. If anyone saw my desk this week, they'd think I'd lost my mind. Strewn across the work surface, a half dozen obscure religious texts lay open, plastered with sticky notes. Behind them, propped open on wooden stands, were three heavy volumes, Hebrew, Aramaic, and English versions of the Torah, each open to the same book, Genesis. In the beginning. Kirvish could, of course, recite Genesis from memory in all three languages. He was more likely to be reading academic commentary on the Zohar or advanced Kabbalistic cosmology theory. For a scholar of Kirvish's caliber, to study Genesis was much like Einstein going back to study grade school arithmetic. Nonetheless, That's what the rabbi had been doing this week, and the notepad on his desk looked to have been assaulted by a wild torrent of hand-scrawled notes, so messy that Kirvish could barely make them out himself. I look like I've turned into a lunatic. Rabbi Kirvish had started with the Torah, the Genesis story shared by Jews and Christians alike. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Next, he had turned to the instructional text of the Talmud, rereading the rabbinic elucidations on Maaseh Bereshit, the act of creation. After that, he delved into the Midrash, poring over the commentaries of various venerated exegetes who had attempted to explain the perceived contradictions in the traditional creation story. Finally, Kirvish buried himself in the mystical Kabbalistic science of the Zohar, in which the unknowable God manifested as 10 different sphirot, or dimensions, arranged along channels called the Tree of Life, and from which blossomed 4 separate universes. The arcane complexity of the beliefs that made up Judaism had always been comforting to Kirvish, a reminder from God that humankind was not meant to understand all things. And yet now, after viewing Edmund Kirsch's presentation and contemplating the simplicity and clarity of what Kirsch had discovered, Kirvish felt like he had spent the past 3 days staring into a collection of outdated contradictions. At one point, all he could do was push aside his ancient texts and go for a long walk along the Danube to gather his thoughts. Rabbi Kirvish had finally begun to accept a painful truth. Kirsch's work would indeed have devastating repercussions for the faithful souls of this world. The scientist's revelation boldly contradicted almost every established religious doctrine, and it did so in a distressingly simple and persuasive manner. I cannot forget that final image, Kirvish thought, recalling the distressing conclusion of Kirsch's presentation that they had watched on Kirsch's oversized phone. This news will affect every human being, not just the pious. Now, despite his reflections over the last few days, Rabbi Kirvish still felt no closer to knowing what to do with the information that Kirsch had provided. He doubted Valdespino and Al-Fadl had found any clarity either. The 3 men had communicated by phone 2 days ago, but the conversation had not been productive. My friends, Valdespino had begun, obviously Mr. Kirsch's presentation was disturbing on many levels. I urged him to call and discuss it further with me, but he has gone silent. Now I believe we have a decision to make. I've made my decision, said Al-Fadl. We cannot sit idly by. We need to take control of this situation. Kirsch has a well-publicized scorn for religion, and he will frame his discovery in a way to do as much damage as possible to the future of faith. We must be proactive. We must announce his discovery ourselves, immediately. We must cast it in the proper light so as to soften the impact and make it as non-threatening as possible to the believers in the spiritual world. I realize we discussed going public, Valdespino said, but unfortunately, I cannot imagine how one frames this information in a non-threatening way. He sighed heavily. There is also the issue of our vow to Mr. Kirsch that we would keep his secret. True, Al-Fadl said, and I too am conflicted about breaking that vow. But I feel we must choose the lesser of 2 evils and take action on behalf of the greater good. We are all under attack, Muslims, Jews, Christians, Hindus, all religions alike. And considering that our faiths all concur on the fundamental truth that Mr. Kirsch is undermining, we have an obligation to present this material in a way that does not distress our communities. I fear there is no way this will make any sense, Valdespino said. If we are entertaining the notion of going public with Kirsch's news, the only viable approach will be to cast doubt on his discovery. to discredit him before he can get his message out. Edmund Kirsch? Alfadl challenged. A brilliant scientist who has never been wrong about anything? Were we all in the same meeting with Kirsch? His presentation was persuasive. Valdespino grunted, no more persuasive than presentations made by Galileo, Bruno, or Copernicus in their day. Religions have been in this predicament before. This is just science banging on our door once again, but on a far deeper level than the discoveries of physics and astronomy, Alfadl exclaimed. Kirsch is challenging the very core, the fundamental root of everything we believe. You can cite history all you like, but don't forget, despite your Vatican's best efforts to silence men like Galileo, his science eventually prevailed, and Kirsch's will too. There is no way to stop this from happening. There was a grave silence. My position on this matter is simple, Valdespino said. I wish Edmund Kirsch had not made this discovery. I fear that we are unprepared to handle his findings. And my strong preference is that this information never see the light of day. He paused. At the same time, I believe that the events of our world happen according to God's plan. Perhaps with prayer, God will speak to Mr. Kirsch and persuade him to reconsider making his discovery public. Alfadl scoffed audibly. I don't think Mr. Kirsch is the kind of man capable of hearing the voice of God. Perhaps not, Valdespino said. But miracles happen every day. Alfadl fired back hotly. With all due respect, unless you're praying that God strikes Kirsch dead before he can announce... Gentlemen, Kirsch intervened, attempting to diffuse the growing tension. Our decision need not be rushed. We don't need to reach a consensus tonight. Mr. Kirsch said his announcement is a month away. Might I suggest that we meditate privately on the matter and speak again in several days? Perhaps the proper course will reveal itself through reflection. Wise counsel, Valdespino replied. We should not wait too long, Alfadl cautioned. Let's speak again, by phone, 2 days from now. Agreed, Valdespino said. We can make our final decision at that time. That had been 2 days ago, and now the night of their follow-up conversation had arrived. Alone in his Hasiko study, Rabbi Kirsch was growing anxious. Tonight's scheduled call was now almost 10 minutes overdue. At last, the phone rang and Kirsch seized it. Hello, Rabbi, said Bishop Valdespino, sounding troubled. I'm sorry for the delay. He paused. I'm afraid Alama Alfadl will not be joining us on this call. Oh? Kirsch said with surprise. Is everything all right? I don't know. I've been trying to reach him all day. But the Alama seems to have disappeared. None of his colleagues have any idea where he is. Kirsch felt a chill. That's alarming. I agree. I hope he is okay. Unfortunately, I have more news. The bishop paused, his tone darkening further. I have just learned that Edmund Kirsch is holding an event to share his discovery with the world. Tonight.
Tonight? Kirsch demanded. He said it would be a month.
Yes, Valdespino said. He lied.
Chapter 6 Winston's friendly voice reverberated in Langdon's headset. Directly in front of you, Professor, you will see the largest painting in our collection, though most guests do not spot it right away. Langdon gazed across the museum's atrium but saw nothing except a wall of glass that looked out over the lagoon. I'm sorry, I think I may be in the majority here. I don't see a painting.
Well, it is displayed rather unconventionally, Winston said with a laugh. The canvas is mounted not on the wall, but rather on the floor.
I should have guessed, Langdon thought, lowering his gaze and moving forward until he saw the sprawling rectangular canvas stretched out across the stone at his feet. The enormous painting consisted of a single color, a monochrome field of deep blue, and viewers stood around its perimeter staring down at it as if peering into a small pond. This painting is nearly 6,000 square feet, Winston offered. Langdon realized it was 10 times the size of his first Cambridge apartment. It is by Eve Klein and has become affectionately known as the swimming pool. Langdon had to admit that the arresting richness of this shade of blue gave him the sense he could dive directly into the canvas. Klein invented this color, Winston continued. It's called International Klein Blue, and he claimed its profundity evoked the immateriality and boundlessness of his own utopian vision of the world. Langdon sensed Winston was now reading from a script. Klein is best known for his blue paintings, but he is also known for a disturbing trick photograph called Leap into the Void, which caused quite a panic when it was revealed in 1960. Langdon had seen Leap into the Void at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. The photo was more than a little disconcerting, depicting a well-dressed man doing a swan dive off a high building and plunging toward the pavement. In truth, the image was a trick, brilliantly conceived and devilishly retouched with a razor blade, long before the days of Photoshop. In addition, Winston said, Klein also composed the musical piece Monotone Silence, in which a symphony orchestra performs a single D major chord for a full 20 minutes.
And people listen?
Thousands. And the one chord is just the first movement. In the second movement, the orchestra sits motionless and performs pure silence for 20 minutes.
You're joking, right?
No, I'm quite serious. In its defense, the performance was probably not as dull as it might sound. The stage also included 3 naked women slathered in blue paint, rolling around on giant canvases. Although Langdon had devoted the better part of his career to studying art, it troubled him that he had never quite learned how to appreciate the art world's more avant-garde offerings. The appeal of modern art remained a mystery to him.
I mean no disrespect, Winston, but I've got to tell you, I often find it hard to know when something is modern art and when something is just plain bizarre.
Winston's reply was deadpan.
Well, that is often the question, isn't it? In your world of classical art, pieces are revered for the artist's skill of execution. That is, how deftly he places the brush to canvas or the chisel to stone. In modern art, however, masterpieces are often more about the idea than the execution. For example, anyone could easily compose a 40-minute symphony consisting of nothing but one chord and silence. But it was Eve Klein who had the idea.
Fair enough.
Of course, the fog sculpture outside is a perfect example of conceptual art. The artist had an idea to run perforated pipes beneath the bridge and blow fog onto the lagoon. But the creation of the piece was performed by local plumbers.
Winston paused. Although I do give the artist very high marks for using her medium as a code.
Fog is a code?
It is. A cryptic tribute to the museum's architect.
Frank Gehry?
Frank O. Gehry, Winston corrected.
Clever.
As Langdon moved toward the windows, Winston said, You have a nice view of the spider from here. Did you see Maman on your way in?
Langdon gazed out the window, across the lagoon, to the massive Black Widow sculpture on the plaza. Yes, she's pretty hard to miss. I sense from your intonation that you're not a fan.
I'm trying to be, Langdon paused. As a classicist, I'm a bit of a fish out of water here.
Interesting, Winston said. I had imagined that you, of all people, would appreciate Maman. She is a perfect example of the classical notion of juxtaposition. In fact, you might want to use her in class when you next teach the concept.
Langdon eyed the spider, seeing nothing of the sort. When it came to teaching juxtaposition, Langdon preferred something a bit more traditional. I think I'll stick with the David.
Yes, Michelangelo is the gold standard, Winston said with a chuckle. Brilliantly posing David in an effeminate contrapposto, his limp wrist casually holding a flaccid slingshot, conveying a feminine vulnerability. And yet David's eyes radiate a lethal determination, his tendons and veins bulging in anticipation of killing Goliath. The work is simultaneously delicate and deadly.
Langdon was impressed with the description and wished his own students had as clear an understanding of Michelangelo's masterpiece.
Maman is no different from David, Winston said. An equally bold juxtaposition of opposing archetypal principles. In nature, the Black Widow is a fearful creature, a predator who captures victims in her web and kills them. Despite being lethal, she is depicted here with a burgeoning egg sac, preparing to give life, making her both predator and progenitor. A powerful core perched atop impossibly slender legs, conveying both strength and fragility.
Maman could be called a modern-day David, if you will.
I won't, Langdon replied, smiling. But I must admit your analysis gives me food for thought.
Good. Then let me show you one final work. It happens to be an Edmund Kirsch original.
Really? I never knew Edmund was an artist.
Winston laughed. I'll let you be the judge of that.
Langdon let Winston guide him past the windows to a spacious alcove in which a group of guests had assembled before a large slab of dried mud hanging on the wall. At first glance, the slab of hardened clay reminded Langdon of a museum fossil exhibit. But this mud contained no fossils. Instead, it bore crudely etched markings similar to those a child might draw with a stick in wet cement. The crowd looked unimpressed.
Edmund did this? Grumbled a mink-clad woman with Botoxed lips. I don't get it.
The teacher in Langdon could not resist.
It's actually quite clever, he interrupted.
So far, it's my favorite piece in the entire museum. The woman spun, eyeing him with more than a hint of disdain.
Oh, really? Then do enlighten me.
I'd be happy to.
Langdon walked over to the series of markings etched coarsely into the clay surface. At the bottom left, five small oval depressions in a row. Then a design resembling a cut-off golf tee with the head of another tee above it. Two of those side by side. To their right, a large V on its side facing outward. But the inside of the V was gently curved, almost like an open mouth. And in the heart of the mouth, an asterisk.
Well, first of all, Langdon said, Edmund inscribed this piece in clay as an homage to mankind's earliest written language, cuneiform.
The woman blinked, looking uncertain.
The three heavy markings in the middle, Langdon continued, spell the word fish in Assyrian. It's called a pictogram. If you look carefully, you can imagine the fish's open mouth facing right, as well as the triangular scales on his body. The assembled group all cocked their heads, studying the work again.
And if you look over here, Langdon said, pointing to the series of depressions to the left of the fish, you can see that Edmund made footprints in the mud behind the fish, to represent the fish's historic evolutionary step onto land. Heads began to nod appreciatively.
And finally, Langdon said, the asymmetrical asterisk on the right, the symbol that the fish appears to be consuming, is one of history's oldest symbols for God. The Botoxed woman turned and scowled at him.
A fish is eating God?
Apparently so. It's a playful version of the Darwin fish, evolution consuming religion. Langdon gave the group a casual shrug. As I said, pretty clever. As Langdon walked off, he could hear the crowd muttering behind him, and Winston let out a laugh.
Very amusing, Professor. Edmund would have appreciated your impromptu lecture.
Not many people decipher that one. Well, Langdon said, that is, in fact, my job. Yes, and I can see now why Mr. Kirsch asked me to consider you an extra special guest. In fact, he asked me to show you something that none of the other guests are going to experience tonight.
Oh? What would that be?
To the right of the main windows, do you see a hallway that is cordoned off? Langdon peered to his right.
I do.
Good. Please follow my directions. Uncertain, Langdon obeyed Winston's step-by-step instructions. He walked to the corridor entrance, and after double-checking that nobody was watching, he discreetly squeezed in behind the stanchions and slipped down the hallway out of sight. Now, having left the atrium crowd behind, Langdon walked 30 feet to a metal door with a numeric keypad. Type these 6 digits, Winston said, providing Langdon with the numbers. Langdon typed the code and the door clicked.
Okay, Professor.
Please enter. Langdon stood a moment, uncertain what to expect. Then, gathering himself, he pushed open the door. The space beyond was almost entirely dark.
I'll bring the lights up for you, Winston said.
Please walk in and close the door. Langdon inched inside, straining to see into the darkness. He closed the door behind him, and the lock clicked. Gradually, soft lighting began to glow around the edges of the room, revealing an unthinkably cavernous space, a single, gaping chamber like an airplane hangar for a fleet of jumbo jets.
34,000 square feet,
Winston offered. The room entirely dwarfed the atrium. As the lights continued to glow brighter, Langdon could see a group of massive forms out on the floor, 7 or 8 murky silhouettes, like dinosaurs grazing in the night.
What in the world am I looking at? Langdon demanded.
It's called The Matter of Time. Winston's cheery voice reverberated through Langdon's headset. It's the heaviest piece of art in the museum. Over 2 million pounds. Langdon was still trying to get his bearings. And why am I in here alone?
As I said, Mr. Kirsch asked me to show you these amazing objects.
The lights increased to full strength, flooding the vast space with a soft glow, and Langdon could only stare in bewilderment at the scene before him.
I've entered a parallel universe.
Chapter 7 Admiral Luis Avila arrived at the museum's security checkpoint and glanced at his watch to assure himself he was on schedule.
Perfect.
He presented his Documento Nacional de Identidad to the employees manning the guest list. For a moment, Avila's pulse quickened when his name could not be located on the list. Finally, they found it at the bottom, a last-minute addition, and Avila was allowed to enter.
Exactly as the regent promised me.
How he had accomplished this feat, Avila had no idea. Tonight's guest list was said to be ironclad. He continued to the metal detector, where he removed his cell phone and placed it in the dish. Then, with extreme care, he extracted an unusually heavy set of rosary beads from his jacket pocket and laid it over his phone.
Gently, he told himself. Very gently.
The security guard waved him through the metal detector and carried the dish of personal items around to the other side.
¡Qué rosario tan bonito!
the guard said, admiring the metal rosary, which consisted of a strong beaded chain and a thick rounded cross.
Gracias,
Avila replied. I constructed it myself. Avila walked through the detector without incident. On the other side, he collected his phone and the rosary, replacing them gently in his pocket before pressing on to a second checkpoint, where he was given an unusual audio headset. I don't need an audio tour, he thought. I have work to do. As he moved across the atrium, he discreetly dumped the headset into a trash receptacle. His heart was pounding as he scanned the building for a private place to contact the regent and let him know he was safely inside. For God, country, and king, he thought. But mostly for God. At that moment, in the deepest recesses of the moonlit desert outside Dubai, the beloved 78-year-old Allama Sayyid al-Fadl strained in agony as he crawled through deep sand. He could go no farther. Al-Fadl's skin was blistered and burned, his throat so raw he could barely pull a breath. The sand-laden winds had blinded him hours ago, and still he crawled on. At one point, he thought he heard the distant whine of dune buggies, but it was probably just the howling wind. Al-Fadl's faith that God would save him had long since passed. The vultures were no longer circling. They were walking beside him. The tall Spaniard who had carjacked Al-Fadl last night had barely spoken a word as he drove the Allama's car deep into this vast desert. After an hour's drive, the Spaniard had stopped and ordered Al-Fadl out of the car, leaving him in the darkness with no food or water. Al-Fadl's captor had provided no indication of his identity or any explanation for his actions. The only possible clue Al-Fadl had glimpsed was a strange marking on the man's right palm, a symbol he did not recognize. For hours, Al-Fadl had trudged through sand and shouted fruitlessly for help. Now, as the severely dehydrated cleric collapsed into the suffocating sand and felt his heart give out, he asked himself the same question he had been asking for hours. Who could possibly want me dead? Frighteningly, he could come up with only one logical answer. Chapter 8 Robert Langdon's eyes were drawn from one colossal form to the next. Each piece was a towering sheet of weathered steel that had been elegantly curled and then set precariously on its edge, balancing itself to create a freestanding wall. The arcing walls were nearly 15 feet tall and had been torqued into different fluid shapes, an undulating ribbon, an open circle, a loose coil. The matter of time, Winston repeated, and the artist is Richard Serra. His use of unsupported walls in such a heavy medium creates the illusion of instability. But in fact, these are all very stable. If you imagine a dollar bill that you curl around a pencil, once you remove the pencil, your coiled bill can stand quite happily on its own edge, supported by its own geometry. Langdon paused and stared up at the immense circle beside him. The metal was oxidized, giving it a burnt copper hue and a raw, organic quality. The piece exuded both great strength and a delicate sense of balance. Professor, do you notice how this first shape is not quite closed? Langdon continued around the circle and saw that the ends of the wall did not quite meet, as if a child had attempted to draw a circle but missed the mark. The skewed connection creates a passageway that draws the visitor inside to explore the negative space. Unless that visitor happens to be claustrophobic, Langdon thought, moving quickly on. Similarly, Winston said, in front of you, you will see three sinuous ribbons of steel running in a loosely parallel formation, close enough together to form two undulating tunnels of more than 100 feet. It's called the Snake, and our young visitors enjoy running through it. In fact, two visitors standing at opposite ends can whisper faintly and hear each other perfectly, as if they were face to face.
This is remarkable, Winston, but would you please explain why Edmund asked you to show me this gallery?
He knows I don't get this stuff.
Winston replied, "The specific piece he asked me to show you is called Torqued Spiral, and it's up ahead in the far right corner. Do you see it?"
Langdon squinted into the distance. "The one that looks like it's a half mile away?"
"Yes, I see it.
Splendid. Let's head over, shall we?" Langdon took a tentative glance around the enormous space and made his way toward the distant spiral as Winston continued speaking. "I have heard, Professor, that Edmund Kirsch is an avid admirer of your work, particularly your thoughts on the interplay of various religious traditions throughout history and their evolutions as reflected in art. In many ways, Edmund's field of game theory and predictive computing is quite similar, analyzing the growth of various systems and predicting how they will develop over time."
"Well, he's obviously very good at it. They call him the modern-day Nostradamus, after all."
"Yes, though the comparison is a bit insulting, if you ask me."
"Why would you say that?" Langdon countered. "Nostradamus is the most famous prognosticator of all time."
"I don't mean to be contrary, Professor, but Nostradamus wrote nearly 1,000 loosely worded quatrains that, over 4 centuries, have benefited from the creative readings of superstitious people looking to extract meaning where there is none. Everything from World War II to Princess Diana's death to the attack on the World Trade Center. It's utterly absurd. In contrast, Edmund Kirsch has published a limited number of very specific predictions that have come true over a very short time horizon. Cloud computing, driverless cars, a processing chip powered by only 5 atoms. Mr. Kirsch is no Nostradamus."
"I stand corrected," Langdon thought.
"Edmund Kirsch was said to inspire a fierce loyalty among those with whom he worked, and apparently Winston was one of Kirsch's avid disciples."
"So are you enjoying my tour?" Winston asked, changing the subject.
"Very much so. Kudos to Edmund for perfecting this remote docenting technology."
"Yes, this system has been a dream of Edmund's for years, and he spent incalculable amounts of time and money developing it in secret."
"Really? The technology doesn't seem all that complicated. I must admit, I was skeptical at first, but you've sold me. It's been quite an interesting conversation."
"Generous of you to say, although I hope I don't now ruin everything by admitting the truth. I'm afraid I have not been entirely honest with you."
"I'm sorry?"
"First of all, my real name is not Winston, it's Art."
Langdon laughed. "A museum docent named Art? Well, I don't blame you for using a pseudonym. Nice to meet you, Art."
"Furthermore, when you asked why I wouldn't just walk around with you in person, I gave you an accurate answer about Mr. Kirsch wanting to keep museum crowds small. But that answer was incomplete. There is another reason we are speaking via headset and not in person." He paused. "I am, in fact, incapable of physical movement."
"Oh, I am so sorry." Langdon imagined Art sitting in a wheelchair in a call center and regretted that Art would feel self-conscious having to explain his condition.
"No need to feel sorry for me. I assure you, legs would look quite strange on me. You see, I'm not quite how you imagine."
Langdon's pace slowed. "What do you mean?"
"The name Art is not so much a name as it is an abbreviation. Art is short for artificial, although Mr. Kirsch prefers the word synthetic." The voice paused a moment. "The truth of the matter, Professor, is that this evening you have been interacting with a synthetic docent, a computer of sorts."
Langdon looked around, uncertain. "Is this some kind of prank?"
"Not at all, Professor. I am quite serious. Edmund Kearse spent a decade and nearly $1 billion in the field of synthetic intelligence, and tonight you are one of the very first to experience the fruits of his labors. Your entire tour has been given by a synthetic docent. I am not human." Langdon could not accept this for a second. The man's diction and grammar were perfect, and with the exception of a slightly awkward laugh, he was as elegant a speaker as Langdon had ever encountered. Furthermore, their banter tonight had encompassed a wide and nuanced range of topics. "I'm being watched," Langdon now realized, scanning the walls for hidden video cameras. He suspected he was an unwitting participant in a strange piece of experiential art, an artfully staged theater of the absurd. "They've made me a rat in a maze." "I'm not entirely comfortable with this," Langdon declared, his voice echoing across the deserted gallery. "My apologies," Winston said. "That is understandable. I anticipated that you might find this news difficult to process. I imagine that is why Edmund asked me to bring you in here to a private space, away from the others. This information is not being revealed to his other guests." Langdon's eyes probed the dim space to see if anyone else was there. "As you are no doubt aware," the voice continued, sounding eerily unfazed by Langdon's discomfort, "the human brain is a binary system. Synapses either fire or they don't. They are on or off, like a computer switch. The brain has over 100 trillion switches, which means that building a brain is not so much a question of technology as it is a question of scale." Langdon was barely listening. He was walking again, his attention focused on an exit sign with an arrow pointing to the far end of the gallery. "Professor, I realize the human quality of my voice is hard to accept as machine-generated, but speech is actually the easy part. Even a $99 e-book device does a fairly decent job of mimicking human speech. Edmund has invested billions." Langdon stopped walking. "If you're a computer, tell me this. Where did the Dow Jones Industrial Average close on August 24, 1974? "That day was a Saturday," the voice replied instantly, "so the markets never opened." Langdon felt a slight chill. He had chosen the date as a trick. One of the side effects of his eidetic memory was that dates lodged themselves forever in his mind. That Saturday had been his best friend's birthday, and Langdon still remembered the afternoon pool party. Helena Woolley wore a blue bikini. "However," the voice added immediately, "on the previous day, Friday, August 23rd, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 686.80, down 17.83 points for a loss of 2.53%. Langdon was momentarily unable to speak. "I'm happy to wait," the voice chimed, "if you want to check the data on your smartphone, although I'll have no choice but to point out the irony of it." "But I don't..." "The challenge with synthetic intelligence," the voice continued, its light British air now seeming stranger than ever, "is not the rapid access to data, which is really quite simple, but rather the ability to discern how the data are interconnected and entangled. Something at which I believe you excel, no? The interrelationship of ideas? This is one of the reasons Mr. Kearse wanted to test my abilities on you specifically."
"A test?" Langdon asked. "Of me?"
"Not at all." Again, the awkward laugh. "A test of me. To see if I could convince you I was human."
"A Turing test?"
"Precisely."
The Turing test, Langdon recalled, was a challenge proposed by codebreaker Alan Turing to assess a machine's ability to behave in a manner indistinguishable from that of a human. Essentially, a human judge listened to a conversation between a machine and a human, and if the judge was unable to identify which participant was human, then the Turing test was considered to have been passed. Turing's benchmark challenge had famously been passed in 2014 at the Royal Society in London. Since then,
AI technology had progressed at a blinding rate. "So far this evening," the voice continued, "not a single one of our guests has suspected a thing. They're all having a grand time."
"Hold on. Everyone here tonight is talking to a computer?"
"Technically, everyone is talking to me. I'm able to partition myself quite easily. You are hearing my default voice, the voice that Edmund prefers. But others are hearing other voices or languages. Based on your profile as an American academic male, I chose my default male British accent for you. I predicted that it would breed more confidence than, for example,
a young female with a southern drawl."
Did this thing just call me a chauvinist? Langdon recalled a popular recording that had circulated online several years ago. Time magazine's bureau chief, Michael Scherer, had been phoned by a telemarketing robot that was so eerily human that Scherer had posted a recording of the call online for everyone to hear. That was years ago, Langdon realized. Langdon knew that Kirsch had been dabbling in artificial intelligence for years, appearing on magazine covers from time to time to hail various breakthroughs. Apparently his offspring, Winston, represented Kirsch's current state of the art. "I realize this is all happening quickly," the voice continued, "but Mr. Kirsch requested that I show you this spiral at which you are now standing. He asked that you please enter the spiral and continue all the way to the center." Langdon peered down the narrow, curving passage and felt his muscles tighten. "Is this Edmund's idea of a college prank?" "Can you just tell me what's in there? I'm not a big fan of cramped spaces."
"Interesting. I didn't know that about you."
"Claustrophobia is not something I include in my online bio." Langdon caught himself, still unable to fathom that he was speaking to a machine.
"You needn't be afraid. The space in the center of the spiral is quite large, and Mr. Kirsch requested specifically that you see the center. Before you enter, however, Edmund asked that you remove your headset and place it on the floor out here."
Langdon looked at the looming structure and hesitated. "You're not coming with me?"
"Apparently not."
"You know, this is all very strange, and I'm not exactly..."
"Professor, considering Edmund brought you all the way to this event, it seems a small request that you walk a short distance into this piece of art. Children do it every day and survive."
Langdon had never been reprimanded by a computer, if that was in fact what this was, but the cutting comment had the desired effect. He removed his headset and carefully placed it on the floor, turning now to face the opening in the spiral. The high walls formed a narrow canyon that curved out of sight, disappearing into darkness.
"Here goes nothing," he said to nobody at all.
Langdon took a deep breath and strode into the opening. The path curled on and on, farther than he imagined, winding deeper, and Langdon soon had no idea how many rotations he had made. With each clockwise revolution, the passage grew tighter, and Langdon's broad shoulders were now nearly brushing the walls.
"Breathe, Robert."
The slanting metal sheets felt as if they might collapse inward at any moment and crush him beneath tons of steel. "Why am I doing this?" A moment before Langdon was about to turn around and head back, the passageway abruptly ended, depositing him in a large open space. As promised, the chamber was larger than he expected. Langdon stepped quickly out of the tunnel into the open, exhaling as he surveyed the bare floor and high metal walls, wondering again if this was some kind of elaborate sophomoric hoax. A door clicked somewhere outside, and brisk footsteps echoed beyond the high walls. Someone had entered the gallery, coming through the nearby door that Langdon had seen. The footsteps approached the spiral and then began circling around Langdon, growing louder with every turn. Someone was entering the coil. Langdon backed up and faced the opening as the footsteps kept circling, drawing closer. The staccato clicking grew louder until, suddenly, a man appeared out of the tunnel. He was short and slender, with pale skin, piercing eyes, and an unruly mop of black hair. Langdon stared stone-faced at the man for a long moment, and then, finally, permitted a broad grin to spread across his face.
The great Edmund Kirsch always makes an entrance.
Only one chance to make a first impression, Kirsch replied affably. I've missed you, Robert. Thanks for coming. The two men shared a heartfelt embrace. As Langdon patted his old friend on the back, he sensed that Kirsch had grown thinner.
You've lost weight, Langdon said.
I went vegan, Kirsch replied, easier than the elliptical.
Langdon laughed. Well, it's great to see you. And as usual, you've made me feel overdressed.
Who, me? Kirsch glanced down at his black skinny jeans, pressed white V-neck tee, and side-zip bomber jacket.
This is couture.
White flip-flops are couture?
Flip-flops?
These are Ferragamo guineas. And I'm guessing they cost more than my entire ensemble.
Edmund walked over and examined the label of Langdon's classic jacket.
Actually, he said, smiling warmly, those are pretty nice tails. It's close.
I've got to tell you, Edmund, your synthetic friend, Winston, very unsettling.
Kirsch beamed.
Incredible, right? You can't believe what I've accomplished in artificial intelligence this year. Quantum leaps. I've developed a few new proprietary technologies that are enabling machines to problem-solve and self-regulate in entirely new ways. Winston is a work in progress, but he improves daily.
Langdon noticed that deep creases had appeared around Edmund's boyish eyes over the past year. The man looked weary.
Edmund, would you care to tell me why you brought me here?
To Bilbao, or into a Richard Serra spiral?
Let's start with the spiral, Langdon said. You know I'm claustrophobic.
Precisely. Tonight is all about pushing people outside their comfort zones, he said with a smirk.
Always your specialty.
Moreover, Kirsch added, I needed to speak to you, and I didn't want to be seen before the show.
Because rock stars never mingle with guests before a concert?
Correct, Kirsch replied jokingly. Rock stars appear magically on stage in a puff of smoke.
Overhead, the lights suddenly faded off and on. Kirsch pulled back his sleeve and checked his watch. Then he glanced to Langdon, his expression turning suddenly serious.
Robert, we don't have much time. Tonight is a tremendous occasion for me. In fact, it will be an important occasion for all of humankind.
Langdon felt a flush of anticipation.
Recently, I made a scientific discovery, Edmund said. It's a breakthrough that will have far-reaching implications. Almost nobody on Earth knows about it, and tonight, very shortly, I will be addressing the world live and announcing what I've found.
I'm not sure what to say, Langdon replied.
This all sounds amazing.
Edmund lowered his voice, and his tone grew uncharacteristically tense.
Before I go public with this information, Robert, I need your advice.
He paused.
I fear my life may depend on it.
Chapter 9. Silence had fallen between the two men inside the spiral. I need your advice. I fear my life may depend on it. Edmund's words hung heavily in the air, and Langdon saw disquiet in his friend's eyes.
Edmund, what's going on? Are you okay?
The overhead lights faded off and on again, but Edmund ignored them.
It has been a remarkable year for me, he began, his voice a whisper. I've been working alone on a major project. One that led to a groundbreaking discovery.
That sounds wonderful.
Kirsch nodded.
It is indeed, and words can't describe how excited I am to share it with the world tonight. It will usher in a major paradigm shift. I am not exaggerating when I tell you that my discovery will have repercussions on the scale of the Copernican Revolution.
For a moment,
Langdon thought his host was joking. But Edmund's expression remained dead serious. Copernicus? Humility had never been one of Edmund's strong suits, but this claim sounded borderline preposterous. Nicholas Copernicus was the father of the heliocentric model.